Why are we doing this Bible survey? What benefit will it be to us? What? Give us a good overview of the Bible. That's exactly right. What benefit is that? Okay, helps us to explain God's plan. That's a good answer. What are the practical? That's a good practical answer. How can it help you as a parent?
When your child is no longer at home, they have kind of some foundation for why they believe what they believe instead of just what mom and dad believe.
Okay, make a good foundation for their faith while they're home and studying this together with the parents. Will it better equip you as a teacher? Hopefully. Obviously, if you know how to use your tools, you can be more adept at whatever you pursue. If I go in the kitchen to cook and I pull out my wife's mixer and I don't even know which speed to put it on or what, how to put the things in it, I'm not going to do very well, Emma. So we can open a Bible and talk about reverencing it, but if we don't know where to turn and how to use it, then it cripples us as teachers, not only to our family, but to our neighbors and brethren. So hopefully this Bible survey will be a practical benefit in the very good answers that you've given, as well as in enabling us to teach. Yes, Sally? Okay, that's a good answer. It helps us to understand how important it is to obey God, because we're seeing what happened throughout the centuries when men did not. That's a good observation. Okay, at the top of your lesson, we have some drill questions we want to work on. Now, we encourage you, when you're doing your study at home, particularly those who have children at home, to work on the 100 questions. Want all to do that. It'll be beneficial to you if you work on all the 100 questions. Because of our time limitations, we don't have time to do that like I'd like to. I'd like to spend about 10 minutes just doing nothing but drill work. But we are limited in our time. So we'll just look at some of these questions at the top here of lesson 14. What notable promise was made to the second king of Israel? What promise?
He said, I will be.
What?
He said, I will be his father and he will be my son. God made that promise to David.
Okay. God made the promise to David that he would be his father and David would be his son. Is that what you're saying? You need to read that again. His son would be that, right? That he would have a son to sit on his throne, and then Sally's point is well made. He would be his father, and he'd be a son. Well, I mean, any son David had, wouldn't that be a son that was he had by the power of God? What's the big deal about that?
The kingdom would be established forever.
That's right. His son would sit on a throne. His dynasty, his rule would be established forever. And so this is obviously talking about what Matthew calls the son of David. Was Joseph a son of David? He wasn't. Yes, he was. Is that what Matthew's talking about throughout his book when he talks about the son of David? No, talking about the Messiah, this promise that we're talking about. Came to be a distinctive term in the Jewish religion for the coming Messiah. Now, this term son of David arises out of this covenant God made with David. And so, when Matthew writes... When did Matthew write his gospel? Approximately. About A.D. 500? About B.C. 300? When did he write his gospel? Come on, class.
Within the
first century. That's right. Probably within 30 to, or maybe years or less from the time Christ arose, died and arose. So he wrote it in the first century. When was this promise made to David? About 1,000 B.C. So that's 1,000 years before. And throughout all those years, they cherished that promise. You remember Isaiah, who prophesied about 700, talked about it, the fact, unto us a son is given. And he would sit on the throne of David, that famous prophecy in Isaiah chapter 7. All right, so this covenant with David is a very important covenant. God made a number of covenants. We looked at one that became the foundation of the rest of your Bible back in Genesis chapter 12. Who was that with?
Abraham.
And now we're looking at this one, which is where, Lily? With David. 2 Samuel 7. Very good. 2 Samuel 7. All right. Riker, what does the term Psalms mean? Psalms. That's right. And Chad, what is the book of Psalms about?
Songs and prayers of the godly.
Songs and prayers of the godly. That's what the book of Psalms is. And so there's what, 233 of them? Is that right?
No.
150. That's right. So here you have a song book. And it's also a book of prayers. It's also called the book of praises. Remember, there were three different terminologies that were used for this particular book. Okay. Who was called the sweet psalmist of Israel?
David.
Why would he be called that? I mean, there are a number of people that wrote psalms, didn't they? Why would he be called the sweet psalmist of Israel? So I could put it on these review questions, right? What? That's right. He wrote over 70 of them. And so the majority of the book, the largest portion, was written by David, the sweet psalmist of Israel. All right. We're in our class today. We're looking at continuing in the Jewish dispensation. And we'll look at these four points that you have in your lesson: Solomon, the Proverbs, the Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. So let's begin with Solomon. In 1 Kings chapter 3, 1 Kings chapter 3, right at the beginning of Solomon's reign. What are 1 and 2 Kings about?
Nation of Israel.
Well, it is about the nation of Israel, all right. About Solomon and the divided kingdom. Right? Okay. If I want to read about the reign of David, where do I read that? 2 Samuel. Right. So you see the term Kings. I want to read about David. No, that's 2 Samuel. So King, Solomon, and then the divided kingdom. So here we're in 1 Kings 3 with Solomon. Now it says in 1 Kings chapter 3 that he prayed a prayer. Look down, if you will, at verse 7, at this prayer that he prayed, or part of it. Now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in the place of my father David. Yet I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Drop down to verse 9. So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine? That sounds like a prayer of a 50-year-old godly man, doesn't it? You have any idea how old he was? When Solomon began his reign, there's a footnote on your lesson. I think it's on your copy. If it's not, it'll be on the upgraded copy. Solomon was possibly as young as 15. Somewhere maybe 15 to 18 years old. That's the indication, the chronological indications that we have in the books about David. And so, here's a young man. Think about it. Think of this audience. Who do we have in here? You don't have to raise your hand, but think of young men and women who are 15 to 18 years old. And what would you teach them to pray for? So here's a man. He said, I realize even though I'm the king, I'm just like a little child. I don't know a lot. God help me to know how to rule these people. That's the prayer of a king. How many of you have been or have the ambition to be a king? Probably no one, right? And yet, I'm looking across this audience at a number of kings. Who are they? The men who rule their household. And then the women who rule those under them. So what an appropriate prayer for anybody in a position of rule to know how to discern between good and evil. What's the right thing to do? And here we've got a conflict between those I rule. How do I make the right judgment? And Solomon is known for that very thing, isn't he? And so when you pray, you say, what am I going to pray for? Here's a good example of what to pray for right here. And we see this in this king. And so I put on your lesson, the wise king. He was a wise king in this request that he made. And it's interesting, as you look at this, in verse 10 it says it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked that thing. So you want to pray a prayer that God is pleased to hear? Sincerely, ask God to bless you in the decisions you make relative to those you may impact. But down in verse 14, it's not enough to know. A person can know the Bible, quote the Bible, argue the Bible, but that doesn't mean they're righteous. Note verse 14. You got an if-then. When you have if-then phrases, those are conditional, worth taking time to look at. So he tells Solomon, if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments as your father walked, then I will prolong your days. Over in chapter 4, so he prayed for wisdom. Here's a short section in Kings about that wisdom that God granted him that exceeded anyone else on the earth during his day. In verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan, the Ezrahite, Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was known in all the surrounding regions. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. What does that tell you about Solomon's writings and your Bible?
Incomplete.
That's right. You don't have everything Solomon wrote. Does it mean something's lost? The Holy Spirit never intended to include everything every inspired man might have said or written. In his wisdom and love, he included in this book what he knew we would need. And so we have a collection of some of Solomon's proverbs and one of his notable songs in the book called The Song of Solomon. So God blessed him with extreme wisdom. So Look over at chapter 11. Now here is a young man with such potential. He had a father who was a man after God's own heart. His father made mistakes, but he was a man that repented and wanted to serve God, gave him a good example, gave him solemn admonition before he died about serving God. And here he's richly blessed. We have people in this audience who are richly blessed. You have parents that have brought you here today because they love you and because they love the Lord. Parents who are trying to make right decisions. You've been given a treasure you cannot buy. But the question is, what do you do with it? All right, look at chapter 11. So, let's look at chapter 11 and verse 1. Now, Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods." Solomon held fast to these in love. If you were to be able to talk to Solomon at this point in his life, you say, "Solomon, don't you know that God warned about taking these women from other nations, these women who are idolaters?" What might he say in response?
"It won't happen to me.
It won't happen to me. I'm the wisest man on the earth. What are you talking about? It won't happen to me." And we've got in this room today young people that know more about the Bible than most of your friends at school know. You have the opportunity to learn a whole lot more if you'll work with your parents, do your own study. But it doesn't mean it's going to benefit you. And we can take a false confidence in knowing. It's not knowing, it's doing. And so you see here, God warned Solomon. But of course, it won't happen to me. I wish it weren't true. I wish that we could say that every young person in this auditorium today will serve the Lord the rest of their lives. But we have no assurance of that. But one of the ways to help ensure it is if every young person and their parents realizes they can reject what they've learned and know. And so this is what happened to Solomon. Look at verse 3. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. So that's why I put on your lesson, the wise but foolish king. Just think if somebody gave you $10 million. Whoa! You'd be set for life, would you? What happens when people get a dump of money? Everybody wants it. They waste it. A lot of times people get rich and they're poverty stricken later. But your parents are giving you, by your opportunity that you have here today and the years of your growing up, something worth more than $10 million. The question is, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? Here's what Solomon did with his. He wasted it. And so he's the wise but foolish king. So tremendous lessons with Solomon. Let's turn to Psalm 72. When you look at the book of Psalms, it's good to pay attention to the superscription. The superscription is the little phrase written right above your psalm. Some Bibles don't have them in it, but most of them do. A little superscription. Not saying that the author put that in there, but these superscriptions are very ancient. So ancient that when the Septuagint translators translated the Old Testament in 150 to 250 BC, some of the terms that were used, they did not know by that period. That's how old they were. So they're of antiquity, they're age. These titles that were put to the Psalms, they're worth looking at. Well, you'll note this one has this little superscription at the top, a Psalm of Solomon. And it's about the righteous king. Verse 1, Give the king thy judgments, O God, and thy righteousness to the king's son. May he judge the people with righteousness, thine afflicted with justice, and on through the psalm. Now, if you take this psalm in a measured sense, it would apply to Solomon. But if you take this psalm universally, unmeasured sense, there's only one person it can apply to. That's Jesus Christ, the King of Righteousness. And it's thought to be a messianic psalm, but you can read that. But nevertheless, that's Psalm 72 by Solomon. All right, and then Psalm 127. Now, how many of the psalms did Moses write? We talked about that earlier. One, right? Psalm 90. But here you have another song of Solomon, Psalm 127. So he wrote at least a couple of the psalms. Now go to the book of Proverbs, chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1. What if you were a citizen, an humble citizen in ancient Israel, and you got an invitation in the mail, and it said, Solomon has granted you a hearing. He's going to give you an hour of his time. And here's the date. You come to the capital, and you'll be able to sit down and talk with him and listen to him. Would you clear your calendar to sit down at the feet of this man that's been given this immense wisdom? Well, we don't have to have a time and date or travel. We can sit down at the feet of this wise man. Wisdom God gave him. Because he didn't practice what he taught doesn't mean his wisdom wasn't good. And young people, remember this. You may see your parents fail in the things they want to do. It doesn't mean the counsel is no good. Because everybody fails. But the counsel may be very good. But here's verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. What a valuable book. What are Proverbs? Well, look down at verse 6 and it tells you. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of their wise and their riddles. The poetic books. What are the poetic books, by the way? How many are there that we usually classify as poetic in the Old Testament? Five. Me holding up my hand, five didn't help any, did it? Five, that's right. And what are they? What's the first one? Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Hosea, right? Oh, Song of Solomon. All right. And the Song of Solomon, that's right. Now, the poetic books, and it's not limited to them, but to appreciate these books, we have to be familiar with the nature of their poetic writing. And one of the most prominent features is parallelism. One line is written and another line is parallel in meaning. Either it's either synonymous, saying the same thing in different words, or it's opposite. The first line says one thing, second line says something totally different. Or the first line introduces a thought and the second line builds on it. That's very helpful because here you have in Proverbs 1:6, so you want to teach the book of Proverbs, so you go get a dictionary and you look up the word proverb. That's valuable. That's good to do. But you can define the word proverb from right here from verse 6 if you understand synonymous parallelism. What is parallel in this verse with the word figure?
Riddles.
That's what it means by figure. The meaning is not laying on the surface. And he indicates that in chapter 2. So that leaves the rest of it to be parallel. So with Proverbs, you have this phrase, the words of the wise. You can't get a better definition of the Proverbs than that. Wise saying, words of the wise. Okay, so Solomon wrote a number of the Proverbs. Look over at chapter 10, verse 1. So you started out with this first verse in the book telling you it's the Proverbs of Solomon. Did the book forget what was in chapter 1:1? It says again in chapter 10:1, the Proverbs of Solomon. And then when you get to chapter 25 and verse 1, these are the Proverbs of Solomon. Why do you got to tell me three times? Because the Proverbs, your book, is actually a collection of Proverbs. And included in that collection are the Proverbs of Solomon, and that's the major part of it. But not all of it is the Proverbs of Solomon. You'll see down a little bit lower, I've got not all by Solomon. So look at chapter 30, verse 1. The words of Agur, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, the son of Jaca, the oracle, the man declares to Ithiel, and Ithiel and Ukel, and then here's some Proverbs. And then you get to 31:1, the words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. Here's some Proverbs by someone else. And there are indications as well when you go to chapter 22 and verse 17. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise and apply your mind to my knowledge. That 22:17 all the way through 24:22 may have been a set of Proverbs by someone else that was included in the book. And then 24:23 through the end of the chapter, verse 34, is another set of Proverbs that were included in the book. You'll note in verse 1 of chapter 25 a little statement. These are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, transcribed. It's thought possibly that Hezekiah was the king that used his scribe to collect these Proverbs into a book. But be that as it may, that particular one is. Whether that's true with all of them, I don't know. But the point is that the Proverbs is a collection of Proverbs by different men, primarily by Solomon. Proverbs, as you say on the lesson here, they're practical rather than theoretical wisdom. And one of the important things to recognize about Proverbs is that they are general principles to which there are exceptions. And so you're going to read things in Proverbs that are very valuable, but it's not true in every single case. And if you don't recognize that, you can misuse the book of Proverbs. All right, let's go to the book of Ecclesiastes. We use that word every day, don't we? And so what does the word Ecclesiastes mean? And I've got here on your lesson, one who addresses assembly, or as you see in verse 1, the words of the preacher. And so here is a lesson about life. It is a unique book in the Bible. It takes a view of life that no other book takes, to my knowledge. Closest might be the Song of Solomon. But it's a view of life on this earth under the sun. And you have that phrase all through the book. Look at verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And if I do not read the book of Ecclesiastes with that in mind, it's going to be a very depressing book. It doesn't talk about heaven, about the eternal reward. It talks about the inequities that exist in our society, that life ends in death, and that's it. You live and you die. And it can be a very depressing book, but it can be a very enlightening book because it teaches you how to live with what God has given you, the time, the blessings, the family, the knowledge, the abilities, how to live life under the sun. Tremendous, valuable book. All right, so the question of the book is verse 3. This is what the book addresses right here. What advantage, or your version say, what profit does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And in verse 14, he said, all is vanity and striving after the wind. So, you live to be an older man or woman. You've spent your life trying to maybe accumulate savings for your future, to gain wisdom, to provide for your mate. And then you die, and what happens? Don't take it with you. As Brother Brandon Fonts, I believe it was, or maybe it was Alex, told me. One guy told him, said, you never see a hearse with a U-Haul behind it. You don't take it with you. And so that's what he says here. It's vanity. That's the idea of fleeting. It's gone. It's gone. Here, catch the wind in your hand. Can you do that? Put it in your pocket? You can't do that. That's the way life is. You got it now, but when it's gone, it's gone. So, here was a rich man. Abundant wealth. And he says in chapter 2, he tried everything. He had gardens, he had ponds, he didn't have CDs. He had women come in and sing choirs. He satisfied the flesh. He did everything. But he said, when it's all said and done, it's fleeting. It's gone. So, what profit is there? No profit in the sense that when it's all done, I can put it in my pocket, take it with me. You can't. So here's how you live. That's what he addresses here in this great book. Look at chapter 2. Verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink. Get fat. No. They're not talking about getting fat. They're not talking about eating and drinking. That's figurative language that they would use for enjoying what you have. That's the idea. To eat and to drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, that it is from the hand of God. You mean God gave us ability and family and mates and children and parents and eyesight and hearing to enjoy? Yes. Yes, from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. It's still fleeting. You can't take it with you, but he's saying enjoy it if God gave it to you. And that admonition recurs throughout the book. And in chapter 3, for example, in verse 16, there is no end to all people, to all who were before them, even to the one who will come after who come later will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity and striving after the wind. At the end of chapter 5, you have this admonition about eating and drinking and enjoying yourself, whatever status you are in society. But it's a great book from that standpoint. Look at chapter 12. If there is a view of heaven in the book, this is it, of eternity. Not even sure that it is. But if there is, this is it. There may be some other hints of it, but this is certainly the concluding exhortation. The conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep His commandments. Now this version says, because this applies to every person. Some versions say, because this is the whole duty of man, which I like. And he said, for God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. And so that is a fact we know, that God will hold man accountable for the choices that he makes in this short life under the sun. Tremendous book, but has to be properly interpreted. Okay, let's look at the Song of Solomon.
Right.
Yes.
Just to clarify, in another verse, what you talked about, you said that the question of Ecclesiastes is in verse 3. Where did you find the answer to that question?
I read it. Chapter 2, 24, 26. Well, first of all, what profit is there? There in chapter 2 and verse 14, he said there's none. 2:17, he said there's none. Chapter 2:1, he said there's none. All three, he said it's futility. Nothing you can take with you. So what do you do? There is no profit. What do? You enjoy it while you have it.
So 2:17 would be a good verse to reference?
It'd be just one of many, yes. 2:17, be good. You go through the book, if you'll look for that thread of word, futility and striving after the wind, you're going to see it recurring over and over and over and over again. That's the answer. There is no advantage. So what do? Go bury yourself in a hole, shoot yourself, commit suicide? No. Enjoy what God gave you. Don't be stupid. Huh? Yeah, in 2:24 through 26 and the end of chapter 5 are just two other areas where he tells you that very thing. Eat and drink. He put it there on the table for you. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. But always with the consciousness that you're still under the dominion of Almighty God. And that's the exhortation of the book. All right, Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon has been interpreted for centuries as a song that typifies Christ in the church. If you have commentaries, it's not unlikely your commentary will talk about that very thing. And it may. But there's a danger. It's a real serious danger in interpretation, is in attributing something to be a type when there is no support in the text or in any other text. And when we start doing that, we make the interpretation of the Bible fanciful. That is, whatever I think it may mean, I attribute that to it. I know of no text that I can turn to, at least, that says that the Song of Solomon and his marriage to this woman is a type of church. If you know one, sometime today you email me or text me and let me know. I don't know of any. It is a love story. It is a triangle love story. It's a valuable piece of literature. What you have in the book is a beautiful young woman, a Shulamite maiden. She's an outdoors girl, but she's pretty. Solomon is the king. He lives in castles. He's got all these women, but he sees that girl and he wants her. What an opportunity to live in the castle. Have all you need supplied. Have servants and maidens and the finest clothes and the finest food. But there's a problem. She's in love with the shepherd boy. She don't love Solomon. She loves the shepherd boy. Now she's got to make a decision. Do I go and be in Solomon's harem? Or do I fulfill my love with this shepherd boy? He can't give me a castle and the finest foods and clothes. But I'll tell you what we can do. We can run the hills together. We can take care of the animals together. We can laugh and love together. That's the decision of the book. So, when you look at the Song of Solomon in chapter 2 and verse 7, here's a little refrain that occurs throughout the book that really gets down to the heart and key of the book. You have these women in Jerusalem who know about this. They had this little song they sing. Woman, what's the matter with you? You ought to jump at this opportunity. And here's the refrain. O daughters of Jerusalem, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the hinds of the field, that you'll not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. You know that there's different kinds of love in the Bible. You know that there's what's called caring love. It has nothing to do with emotions, except you may have to overcome your emotions. You care about people. That's not the love of Song of Solomon. There is a love that refers to sexual enjoyment. And while that's hinted at in Solomon, that's not really the thread of the book. It's that second kind of love. It's the love of emotion, affection, attachment, feelings. That's the focus of the book. And so when it says, you will not arouse or awaken my love until it pleases. Caring love is commanded. You don't have to feel it. It's commanded. Sexual love is something you participate in for good or bad. This kind of love is occasioned by delight in the other person. You can't command it. You can't force it. And that's what she's telling these women. You can't make me love Solomon. You can't force it. And throughout the book, she wrestles with this till you get to chapter 8 and verse 6. Let me look at verse 4. Here's that little refrain again. I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. And then you have this little refrain. Who is this coming up for the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy, or I like the footnote better. Its ardor is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire. The very flame of the Lord. Here is the statement that's so valuable. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, he'd be utterly despised. The love he's talking about, you can't buy. Men have made that mistake. I'll give her things and a credit card and cars, but not give her attention and tenderness. And those. No, you can't buy it. You cannot buy it. And if it's burning strongly, nobody can destroy it. Now, you can let it die, but it's an intense flame. That's what the Song of Solomon is about. Great, great book. All right, quickly our quiz. Number one, Solomon, what's the correct answer or answers?
All of them.
He was the third king of Israel. He built the temple, wrote two of the Old Testament books. What are they?
Ecclesiastes,
Song of Solomon, major part of another. Which one is that?
Proverbs,
and then a small part of the fourth. What is that one? Psalms. Right. Okay. And then, of course, was known for his wisdom. What's the correct answer on number two? D. None of the above. Not a book of Hebrew grammar. I've told you the story. I don't know if you were in the audience when I told it. It was a guy named Stanley Lovett, a gospel preacher, trying to talk to a fellow about words and their meanings, about verbs and nouns and that kind of thing. And he said, now, you know, the Bible doesn't say adjective, noun, verb, but we want to know about it. He said, oh, yes, the Bible talks about verbs. He said, where? Proverbs. And the guy was serious, I guess. And that's the ignorance sometimes of people. But none of the above. Not a book of Hebrew grammar. Not simply for young people. We say, here, children, you need to read this. No, he said in the beginning, the wise man will increase learning. Ecclesiastes, number three. What does it mean? The preacher, right? Not a book of heavenly value. It doesn't deny the existence of life after death. It's just not about that. That's the point. And it's not about the Ecclesiastes brothers. I know a lot of you probably put that one. But anyway. And then the Song of Solomon. Number four, C, a eulogy to wholesome, affectionate love. God made men and women to ability with the ability to love, fall in love. That's this kind of love. And for it to be intense, and he wants us to enjoy it. It's a great song about that. The Old Testament books generally refer to poetry, or we answered that earlier, Job's Song, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Okay, our time is up. Thank you for your participation in the class.